day in the valley of Montana's Greasy Grass River, which the white man's maps labeled the Little Bighorn. 6 tribal circles of Lakotas and 1 of Northern Cheyennes, the coalition of winter roamers, sprawled for nearly 3 miles down the narrow valley, rimmed on the east by the snow-fed river. The Hunkpapas occupied the extreme upper end of the village, the Cheyennes the lower. In between rose the lodges of Blackfeet, Minneconjou, Sonark, Ogallala, and Brule. It was an unusually large village, 7,000 people, 2,000 warriors housed in thousands of teepees and wickiups. In the past few days, Indians arriving from the agencies had swollen the village. Sitting Bull's Lodge on the southern edge of the Hunkpapa circle sheltered 12 people besides the chief, 2 wives, his mother, 2 teenage daughters, 3 sons, 2 stepsons, his sister, and the brother of his 2 wives. He treasured his family. On this hot summer day, some of the men rode up to the bench land west of the valley to tend their grazing pony herds. After a night of dancing and feasting, others dozed in their teepees or beneath the tall cottonwood trees shading the riverbank. Children played in the cool waters of the stream. Women dug for wild roots. In the middle of the afternoon, a current of anxiety ran through the village, disturbing the peaceful scene. Shortly, heralds rode through each circle. "They are charging! The chargers are coming!" they cried. They were coming, and they were soon within sight of Sitting Bull's Lodge. "I heard a terrific volley of carbines," recalled Moving Robe Woman. "The bullets shattered the teepee poles. Women and children were running away from the gunfire." In the tumult, Moving Robe Woman recalled, "I heard old men and women singing death songs for their warriors who were now ready to attack the soldiers. One Bull and White Bull galloped down from the bench to help their uncle prepare for battle. Old man chiefs were not supposed to fight, but he had to defend himself and his family. Astride a large black horse, brandishing a Winchester rifle, he hurried among warriors pouring from their teepees. 'Brave up, boys! It'll be a hard time. Brave up!' White Bull shouted. But the chargers quit charging. They got off their horses and lay on the ground, firing at the Hunkpapa teepees. Sitting Bull dismounted and joined others, including the venerated chief Four Horns, in a shallow draw from which to shoot back. White Bull called this standstill shooting. Soon warriors from the other tribal circles began reaching the scene, many following the indomitable Oglala, Crazy Horse. The standstill shooting ended. Crazy Horse and the arriving warriors drove the soldiers into timber enclosed by a bend in the river. Now on the defensive, the troopers fought back, though ineffectively. In about 20 minutes, they mounted and burst from the timber, racing across the open valley toward a line of high bluffs on the other side of the river, every man for himself. Warriors rode among them, striking them down as they sought to save themselves. They jumped into and crossed the river, then climbed the bluffs to the top. They had lost 30 killed and 13 wounded. Sitting Bull had not ridden in this rout of the soldiers. As long as they remained in the valley, he fired his Winchester at them and encouraged his young men to fight. After the soldiers had reached the top of the bluffs, he rode about the valley examining the carnage, then crossed the river and climbed one of the ravines, scouring the bluffs. At the top, soldiers had formed into a defensive circle and were exchanging fire with Indians scaling the heights. One Bull recalled that his uncle was back from on the hill, sort of directing things, though he himself did not go into the fight at all. Appropriate behavior for an old man chief. He even remarked to one bull that the warriors should let the soldiers go back home and tell the whites what had occurred on these bluffs. But there were still more soldiers to fight. They had been glimpsed downstream, opposite the lower end of the village. The word passed among the Indians like a whirlwind, said Red Horse, and they all started to attack this new party, leaving the troops on the hill. Accompanied by One Bull, Sitting Bull joined the other warriors, hastening north along the ridgetops. Soon they spotted the new threat, many soldiers already fighting against converging warriors. Instead of joining the fight, Sitting Bull left One Bull and worked his way down to a broad coulee to the river, splashed across, and rode to where the women and children had gathered beyond the Cheyenne Circle. He saw his duty as helping to protect the women and children, rather than exposing himself in the battle that he could see developing on a high ridge across the river. Smoke and dust obscured the details of the fighting rolling along the crest of the ridge. Within an hour, Sitting Bull learned the outcome. The warriors had annihilated the entire contingent of soldiers, including Long Hair Custer. Sitting Bull's prayers had been answered, and his prophecy validated by the greatest triumph in the history of his people. The soldiers who had first attacked the village remained on the bluffs 4 miles to the south. Warriors rode in that direction to resume the battle. They found that more soldiers had arrived to strengthen the ones who had retreated from the valley. They had scooped out shallow rifle pits and fired at the returning warriors. Sitting Bull and One Bull took station on a high ridge overlooking the defenders and fired shots at them. Shortly, however, Sitting Bull went back to his lodge in the valley. Here he witnessed the sad spectacle of dead and wounded warriors draped over the backs of horses, borne down from the heights. The battle that had killed so many soldiers had also brought grief to families in the valley. The fight for the hilltop resumed early the next morning. Sitting Bull remained until noon, when he climbed the bluffs. Again, he believed the fighting should end. Let them go now, so some can go home and spread the news. I just saw more soldiers coming. More soldiers did come, south up the valley. People in the village discovered their approach and at once began to dismantle their teepees and pack for a hasty flight. Sitting Bull returned to his lodge and with his family joined the procession up the valley, away from the oncoming soldiers. The battle was over, but the war wasn't. The white people were furious. They could hardly believe that Long Hair Custer and 225 men of the 7th Cavalry Regiment had met with such a catastrophe. Even the generals were at first skeptical. When the truth dawned on the nation, Sitting Bull personified the calamity. Fresh soldiers poured up the Yellowstone to join with those already in the field. Revenge was the watchword. As they pursued the conquest of the Lakotas, one name loomed above all other chiefs, Sitting Bull. He was the man to get. He was not easy to get. The Great Lakota Coalition split into several components, some bearing south, others north. Sitting Bull chose the latter. Word that buffalo ranged the plains north of the Yellowstone lured Sitting Bull north and across the Yellowstone, which he forded on October 10, 1876. Many Conjus and Sonarks accompanied the Hunkpapas. The next day, they spotted a large encampment of army supply wagons opposite the mouth of Glendive Creek. Warriors attacked but were driven off by the soldiers. Afterward, the wagons formed into a train and began moving up the river. On October 15 and 16, One Bull and fellow warriors swarmed around them, only to be thwarted again by walk-a-heap soldiers, infantry armed with long, high-powered rifles. In the Lakota village, the chiefs debated whether to try to make peace with the soldier chief. Sitting Bull still harbored the same thoughts he had on the Little Bighorn Bluffs when he advised his men to let the soldiers go. He had not joined in the attack on the soldier encampment, nor in the subsequent assaults of his warriors. Now he favored a gesture toward the soldiers. In the camp was a mixed-blood man named John Brugger. He had ridden into the Lakota camp a month earlier, seeking sanctuary from the law. Sitting Bull allowed him to remain. Because he wore flapping leg chaps, the Indians called him Big Leggings. Sitting Bull dictated a message, which Brugger wrote down. It was tacked to a stake and driven into the center of the road the wagon train was following. "I want you to know what you are doing on this road. You scare all the buffalo away. I want to hunt on this place. I want you to turn back from here. If you don't, I will fight you again. I want you to leave what you have got here and turn back from here. I am your friend, Sitting Bull. I mean all the rations you have got and some powder. Wish you would write as soon as you can." They were Big Leggings' awkward words, but Sitting Bull's thoughts. Highly presumptuous, but not without modest result. Two emissaries advanced on the halted train. The soldier chief would not talk with them, only Sitting Bull. Reluctantly, Sitting Bull joined with several other chiefs and walked to the train. He gestured to his companions to do the talking. They pressed the officer for food and ammunition and peace. He replied that they had fired a lot of their ammunition today attacking his train, and moreover, he had no authority to make peace, nor would he feed them, although when the train continued up the Yellowstone, he left behind token supplies of hard bread and bacon. Gathering the paltry supplies piled next to the road, the Lakotas moved farther to the northwest, and on October 20th discovered a herd of buffalo. They encamped on the heights dividing the Missouri and Yellowstone rivers and sallied forth to attack the herd. Almost at once, however, scouts brought word of still more soldiers advancing on their trail. The Lakotas gathered on the ridge and watched the soldiers form in line of battle. To ward off another attack, Sitting Bull hazarded another talk with the soldiers. Two emissaries rode toward them with a white flag. "These troops were on the warpath," said one of the two. "We ran great risk in going to them, but we went directly to them." After an hour of confusion on both sides, a parley was arranged. Groups from each side advanced toward each other. Accompanied by an array of chiefs, Sitting Bull led his party. They bore no arms, although a mounted contingent of armed warriors followed. The day was sunny and clear, but bitter cold. A heavy buffalo robe covered Sitting Bull's plainly attired frame. The soldier chief and his staff rode toward them. They dismounted and hesitantly sat on buffalo robes spread on the ground. Big Leggings stood nearby to interpret. Sitting Bull faced an officer who was to play a large role in his life. To ward off the cold, he wore a fur cap and a long overcoat trimmed in bear fur. Bear Coat, the Indians dubbed him, a name that endured through 4 years of contention and battle. He was Colonel Nelson A. Miles, whose 5th Infantry Regiment was building winter quarters on the Yellowstone at the mouth of Tongue River. Tall and well-proportioned, with a neat black mustache, he was intensely ambitious, determined to gather all the power and rank he could. His wife's uncle, General William T. Sherman, headed the army. Bear Coat intended to stay on the northern plains throughout the winter and carry the war to Sitting Bull, to capture or kill him. Sitting Bull would find this man a dangerous opponent, the more so because he was inclined to stretch his orders to the limit and beyond to swell his reputation. The talks lasted for 2 days. Amid the many words, two thoughts prevailed. Bear Coat demanded that Sitting Bull surrender and do as the government wished. Sitting Bull steadfastly refused and told Bear Coat to leave him alone. Frustrated, at the end of the second day, both sides formed for battle. The soldiers attacked, and the Indians fought back from higher positions. The fighting continued inconclusively for 2 days as the Indians made their way 42 miles back to the Yellowstone, abandoning food and camp equipage on the way. En route, Sitting Bull and his immediate Hunkpapa following peeled off and turned back north. The many Conjus and Sonarks crossed the river and surrendered to Miles. Sitting Bull's nephew, White Bull, went with the Miniconjus because he had married into the Miniconju tribe. One Bull remained with his uncle. For Sitting Bull, the brutal winter of 1876-77 brought suffering from hunger, poverty, bitter cold with weeks of rain and snow, and repeated hasty moves to avoid Bear Coat's relentless campaign. The soldiers kept to the field all winter, ranging up and down the Missouri River, where it flows east before turning south. On December 18th, a unit of Miles' soldiers overtook Sitting Bull's village of about 120 lodges and attacked. The Indians abandoned their dwellings and fled south, the soldiers in pursuit. Left behind, besides ponies, food, and all other possessions, were piles of buffalo robes, which the soldiers took back to their winter quarters to have made into overcoats. Increasingly destitute, increasingly frightened by Bear Coat, Sitting Bull agonized in uncertainty. Increasingly, he pondered taking refuge in Canada, the land of the White Mother. This option grew more appealing as Four Horns, Black Moon, and other Hunkpapa chiefs crossed the line late in 1876. In the Lakota mind, the boundary took on almost spiritual meaning. "They told us that this line was considered holy," recounted one of the Lakotas. "They called that a holy trail. They believe things are different when you cross from one side to another. You are altogether different. On one side, you are perfectly free to do as you please. On the other, you are in danger." Sitting Bull did not view Canada in such simplistic terms. He did not want to leave his own country, and he avoided a decision even as his shrinking following moved closer to the Holy Line during the early months of 1877. On March 17, they crossed the Missouri River and pitched their shelters on the north bank. That night, the winter's ice pack in the Missouri River broke up and sent a giant wall of water down the river. It swept over the Lakota camp and damaged or destroyed nearly all their possessions. Everyone recognized that the time for decision was overdue. On April 10th, 60 miles north of the Missouri, they convened a council of a dozen chiefs. Sitting Bull spoke in favor of continuing the war until the white soldiers surrendered. Not for the last time, his wishful thinking had converted fantasy into reality. Contradicting himself, he declared that he would cross the boundary and wait until he could discover how the people who had preceded him were treated. Sitting Bull had been in Canada before, principally to trade with the Red River mixed bloods the Lakotas called Slotas. Now Canada posed uncertainties. Were there enough buffalo to feed the Lakotas? Would the tribes native to Canada welcome or fight them? Would Canadian authorities treat them fairly? These and other unknowns plagued Sitting Bull and his followers, but all paled before the reality of poverty and constant fear of Bear Coat's soldiers suddenly dashing into their village, a village grown much smaller because so many of the Lakotas, including Four Horns and Black Moon, had already sought refuge in Canada. Despite the conclusions reached in the Chiefs' Council of April 10th, Sitting Bull and his people continued to move slowly northward. The village now counted 135 lodges, about 1,000 people, and all suffered terribly from the Missouri River flood that tore through their dwellings. They edged up Milk River from its confluence with the Missouri, then turned north on Frenchman's Creek. Early in May 1877, they crossed the Chenku Wakon, the Sacred Road. Now in Canada, they continued up Frenchman's Creek, which the Canadian maps labeled White Mud Creek. About 60 miles farther, they reached a headland called Pinto Horse Butte. Watered by the white mud, which rose in the timbered cypress hills to the west, Pinto Horse Butte rested on the northwestern end of Wood Mountain. It afforded a good place to camp without worrying about Bear Coat. The people had rested a few days when lookouts sighted 7 mounted men approaching the village. Some wore scarlet coats and white helmets. They boldly advanced, seemingly unafraid of the Indians, dismounted, and walked toward the teepees. The Lakota lookouts had been circling the party long enough to bring word to the village of the intruders. Who they were remained to be learned. On the History Trail with the Old Bison, a memoir. I first met Robert M. Utley in May 1977. He came to Bloomington to receive a Distinguished Alumni Service Award from Indiana University. I was a graduate student in history at IU at that time, and as soon as I learned that Utley was coming to campus, I sought out my mentor, Martin Ridge, to beg for the opportunity to pick up our guest at the Indianapolis airport and deliver him back. I assured Ridge that I would positively die for the opportunity to meet Utley. He thought this but a slight ambition, and never tired of reminding me of it in later years, but agreed to allow me to play chauffeur. This eventful meeting was, as Bogart said to Raines in Casablanca, the beginning of a beautiful friendship, as Utley became a surrogate father and professional champion for me across the nearly half century to follow. The following year, I accepted a position as assistant editor to the Western Historical Quarterly at Utah State University. I later learned that Utley had written an unsolicited letter on my behalf to Professor George Ellsworth, the WHQ editor, and that had sealed the deal for me. This position, in which I remained for 7 years, gave me high visibility in Western history circles at a very young age. During this time, Utley also carefully critiqued my dissertation on General Phil Sheridan. His devastating assessment and wise edits sent me back to the drawing board. I rewrote the book along the lines he suggested. He thought it dreadfully dull and far too academic. The end result, Phil Sheridan and his army not only won a Spur Award from the Western Writers of America, but also the prestigious Ray Allen Billington Prize from the Organization of American Historians. My career was firmly set in the worlds of both academic and popular Western writing, thanks to Bob Utley. In 1984, I accepted a teaching position at the University of New Mexico, and not long afterward moved to El Dorado, just outside Santa Fe, where Bob lived. We often debated history points as he worked on his books, with me urging him to be a bit tougher on his hero, Custer, in Cavalier and Buckskin, and to cut my hero, Billy, a break in his Billy the Kid, A Short and Violent Life. Even though he once barked at me in exasperation that all you 60s hippies think young people don't have to take responsibility for any of their actions, he nevertheless dedicated Billy the Kid to me. It was quite daunting to watch his incredible productivity in those years. In these years, as neighbors, Bob and I often traveled together to history meetings. none was more memorable than our overland expedition from Santa Fe to Fort Riley, Kansas, in 1989, to attend the annual Little Bighorn Associates Conference. John Carroll was the grand poobah of the LBHA, and he had especially urged Bob to attend, for he was certain that Cavalier and Buckskin would win the Best Custer Book Prize that year. As we made the long drive from Santa Fe to Fort Riley, Bob gently lectured me on the importance of going to accept awards, no matter how obscure they might be. It was wonderful to bask in the glow of his noblesse oblige and to feel warm by his willingness to travel so many miles toward the Custer Buffs for their generosity with a personal appearance. Carroll had arranged for Bob to give the banquet address to the several hundred attendees so he could be seated at the head table when the Best Book Award was announced. I sat in the back of the room with friends and was rather surprised at the tepid response to Bob's address. Many of the Custer Buffs were uncomfortable with Bob's candid comments on Custer's marital infidelities, for they did not wish to see their hero descend from his marble pedestal to the level of the rest of humanity. I sensed trouble. When the Best Book Award was announced, Bob was almost out of his seat before he realized it had gone to a book on the day-by-day movement of the 7th Cavalry from Reconstruction duty in Kentucky to North Dakota in 1973. The next morning, a chagrined John Carroll bade us farewell as we began the long drive back to Santa Fe. It was a pretty quiet drive, but somewhere near Wagon Mound, New Mexico, I suddenly became convulsed with laughter. Utley was not amused and inquired of what so tickled me, although that was not the exact language he employed. "Well," I replied, "I was delighted to have finally come to clearly understand the meaning of the ending of one of my favorite films, John Huston's Treasure of the Sierra Madre. At the end of the film, the surviving protagonists are convulsed with laughter, despite the loss of both companions and treasure, as they realize the insanity of their own hubris. Our friends in the LBHA had just taught us that valuable lesson, that one that our hero, Custer, only learned in the last hour of his life. We laughed all the way back to Santa Fe." Many trips, many awards, and many television shows together followed, but none could ever quite match that magical trip to Fort Riley, Kansas. 10 years ago, I hosted a surprise 80th birthday for Bob in Scottsdale with many of his friends and protégés in attendance, and repeated that in 2020 for his 90th birthday. I plan to do the same in 2029 for his 100th. Now I worry a bit that I may not make it, but I have no doubt that the indestructible Robert M. Utley, the old bison, will be there. Red, White, and Black, The U.S. Army in the West, 1866 to 1891. After 4 years of fighting, the Civil War ended. The victorious Union Army soon disbanded, leaving behind a small force of regulars to such diverse duties as guarding the eastern seaboard, serving as an occupation force in the South during Reconstruction, and returning to its numerous functions in the West. The work in the West often proved frustrating, especially because after Lee's surrender, the authorized strength of the U.S. Army shrank to 54,302 officers and men, while the salary of a private was decreased $3 per month, which represented nearly a 20% reduction in pay. Matters worsened over time. From the mid-1860s through the late 1890s, the actual total force of the regular army averaged a scant 25,000 men. Among these frontiersmen in blue were new additions. For the first time, the rank and file included African Americans, many of the earliest recruits having been enslaved prior to joining the colors. Eventually, they came to be known as Buffalo Soldiers. The same legislation that added blacks to the U.S. Army rolls also called for the enlistment of up to 1,000 Indian scouts. Apaches, Cheyennes, Yavapai, Pimas, Crows, Arikaras, and other members of the other Indian tribes served alongside blacks and whites. A large number of the whites hailed from Europe, with a strong representation from the British Isles and today's Germany. Regardless of origins, the burdens caused by a lack of manpower and the shortage of funds meant all labored under a divided command structure. Nominally, the commanding general who served in Washington, D.C., exercised control over the far-flung force. However, conflicts with the Secretary of War regarding policy and the fact that the Army staff was responsible directly to the Secretary and not to the commanding general caused internal friction and seriously impaired the effort to pacify the Indians. A further complication stemmed from geography. The post-war Army, as was the pre-war Army, was divided into regional departments. A commander assumed responsibility over each of these regions for operations in his area. As the Indians often moved across the boundaries of a given region, pursuit by troops from one command to another could prove a source of friction. Another bone of contention arose from many of the officers in the post-war Army having held higher ranks during the war than their assignments afterwards. In addition, a system of brevets or honorary ranks given in recognition of meritorious service in the war caused jealousy, as many officers refused to acknowledge that someone who had been their subordinate during the war should now hold a higher rank than they held. Despite such rifts in the first years following the Civil War, the focus of attention on the Central and Northern Plains areas kept various commanders and several commands more than busy. U.S. Army infantrymen and their comrades in other branches were required to serve from Mexico to the Canadian border. These units, stationed in the West particularly, bore the brunt because they policed a territory comprised of well over one half of the continental United States. In this vast domain ran overland routes needing to be protected. The Smoky Hill Trail in Kansas, the Bozeman from Fort Laramie to the diggings in Montana, the Gila Trail across the Southwest from Texas to California, and others required military escorts and patrols. Likewise, the construction of the railroad, including the Union Pacific, Central Pacific, and the Santa Fe, made the protection of soldiers necessary. The tribes believed with a certain degree of validity that these iron horses helped chase away the already diminishing game so vital to their existence. When not assaulting the encroaching railroad, American Indians occasionally targeted telegraph wires, requiring patrols to guard crews building or repairing the talking wires. To protect these lines of communication and transportation, troops, especially foot soldiers, were stationed at strategic areas. In theory, this practice made it possible for them to respond quickly to any threat. The presence of posts also tended to encourage settlements because of the protection they afforded and because of the economic benefits that could be gained by supplying various goods to the soldiers and their families. For the most part, however, Uncle Sam's frontline soldiers remained for much of the year in garrisons, which more often than not were remote, tiny outposts removed from major settlements. For these frontier regulars and the women who shared their many trials, garrison duty could be tedious, primitive, and lonely. And the staff side labored under regulations, which classed them all, from the colonel's lady to Rosie O'Grady, as camp followers. Yet they bore children, raised families, made homes out of substandard government quarters, and tended to the many thankless chores that fell to their lot. Not just silent observers, many women participated to the fullest. In several instances, they left behind compelling memoirs of the glittering misery they endured and somehow transcended. For the men, alcoholism and desertion were twin evils. Diversions and pastimes varied, occasionally bringing a respite from monotonous drill, construction duties, and other daily routine. Sometimes the troops stepped in to preserve law and order or aid victims of natural disasters. Here, in addition to marital pursuits, they built the fort's structures, kept the posts supplied with firewood, cleaned equipment, and even raised their own food to supplement the monotonous ration provided by the government. As with the government-issue foodstuffs, the garrison itself lacked major variation. Routine fluctuated little and contributed to the formation of a structured community, one post resembling the next except for differences in local building materials. A parade ground usually formed the heart of the installation, serving as a sort of village green. Here stood the flagpole with Old Glory waving overhead as a symbol of government authority. Here the men assembled and carried out the rituals of their trade, guard mount, reviews, and similar ceremonies. At first, these military evolutions relied on drill developed before the Civil War. But before long, a new infantry manual, written during 1866-67 by a brave brevet major general from the Civil War, appeared to supplant earlier versions. While assigned to the cadre at West Point, Emory Upton penned his Infantry Tactics, which soon became a standard for foot soldiers. In short order, his two companion volumes for the cavalry and artillery, published in 1874 and 1875 respectively, became the Army's Holy Trinity of tactics. Along with the new manual came improved weapons. Although foot soldiers, serving immediately after Lee's surrender, found themselves armed with the same muzzle-loading rifles they had carried against the South, efforts to introduce breech-loading firearms as replacements gained momentum. Foot soldiers were issued converted Civil War period muskets refitted with a sleeve in the barrel to reduce the cartridges from 58 caliber to 50 caliber, and with the breeches cut out to insert new flip-up blocks. These improved pieces of ordnance increased the rate of fire and proved popular with troops when they engaged an enemy used to the U.S. Army's slower-loading muskets of the past. In 1867, infantrymen stationed in today's Wyoming demonstrated the worth of these breech loaders over older models of infantry armament. While engaged in a woodcutting detail for recently established Fort Phil Kearny, the foot soldiers and civilian contractors working the local forest came under heavy attack by a superior force of Lakotas, perhaps 1,000 warriors against some 40 whites. Not long before, 80 men from the same post under Captain William Fetterman of the 18th U.S. Infantry had been slaughtered. Now, it appeared that a repeat of this previous disaster was about to occur. Fortunately for the besieged detail, they took refuge behind the beds of what the wagons that had been removed from their running gears to provide conveyance for trees being felled. Using the wagon boxes as a makeshift fortification, which gave the name to this engagement, the determined defenders repelled wave after wave of mounted Indians. They held their ground, good marksmanship, grit, and new breech loaders kept them from sharing the fallen Fetterman's fate. Such attacks near posts, however, were uncommon, despite the Hollywood cliché. More typically, infantrymen and their mounted comrades in the cavalry set out in the spring or summer on campaigns that took them far from their barracks homes. These field operations often were the cause of considerable human suffering and significant expense to the national treasury. Despite these costs, results regularly were unimpressive. For every noteworthy clash carried as a banner headline by the Eastern and European press, hundreds of other encounters went unnoticed or were all but forgotten. How the soldiers viewed the Indians they pursued as part of government policies offers one perspective into the lack of understanding that led to war between the two groups. In the final analysis, the Army was as much a victim of the Indians in the tragic period between the mid-1860s and the early 1890s. Their lot was a thankless, thorny existence of boredom, sometimes broken by the adventure of camping. The Mexican Revolution's Matajari. The elements of this story are as old as war. A beautiful spy, betrayal, a warning given and not taken, a pistol left for protection, and the destruction of a town, and created one of the most unusual of victories for the revolutionaries in war-torn Mexico. No one, until it was too late, could believe that Helene had deceived them, and so easily. Above all others, Rosa King felt the betrayal more acutely. General Victoriano Huerta turned to Helene, standing beside me, radiant with triumph and more beautiful than ever. And as he bent low over her hand, I little realized what I had done to him and to myself by introducing her. Posing as a journalist, Helene doubled as a spy for Pancho Villa and Zapata, thus making her vulnerable in a world dominated by men, and yet that very vulnerability brought her great power and success. As with so many spies, there are, to date, no known photos of the woman, although descriptions of Helene are quite dramatic. She was dark and fascinating, as a classic beauty who had no qualms about trading sexual favors for military information. As a periodista, a journalist, she was given access to military and civilian power centers and social gatherings. King and Pontypirani met in Mexico City in 1914. Pontypirani was in demand as a sophisticated young beauty who was constantly invited to all the best fiestas of the elegant city. She claimed to represent a number of French newspapers covering the Mexican Revolution, and Rosa King was a natural and easy contact because she ran the Bella Vista Hotel, described at the time as Cuernavaca's finest. King got along well with all sides and was respected by everyone. The rebels needed information on how to best defeat the Federales. Thus, the Romanian correspondent deliberately developed a friendship with Rosa King. Arriving in the Pueblo under the wing of Mrs. King, she could observe and report on conditions in that logistically important locale with little suspicion. She was also to get a travel permit from El Presidente, Victoriano Huerta, an incompetent and foolish old man who was easily swayed by a pretty girl's flirtatious ways. During their visit, Helene was described as lovely and patrician, dressed all in gray with a smart hat that showed off her black hair and lustrous curls. Helene's eyes fairly darted sparks. "That is what I like in people," she said to Huerta, "the power, the force that makes things happen." Needless to say, General Huerta magnanimously granted the permit, noting he would put a double guard on the train to protect both women. He did warn them, however, to return to Mexico City as soon as possible for their own safety. He was pleasant enough, but in July 1914, a few months after his encounter with Helene, he was ousted from power. Unfortunately, the violence and chaos of war had caused life in beautiful Cuernavaca to become one of strife and deprivation. The ancient city had an almost abandoned, desolate feel hanging over it, and the valley guarded by the famous Mexican volcanoes Iztaccíhuatl and Popocatépetl appeared that way, too. The once grand homes were boarded up and no one walked the streets after dark. A few vagrants and lonely dogs were reminders of the hardships now facing the people. Fountains no longer graced gardens, and cascading flowers of violet and pink bougainvillea had long since withered. Zapata had first taken the city in 1911, but federal forces forced them to retreat, and now it was a cat-and-mouse game. The military officers were bored, and a sense of neglect possessed them even as Helene and Rosa arrived at Bella Vista. Rosa wrote, "I could not help laughing at their stupefaction and delight when they caught sight of Helene Pontepirani. It was a long time since they had seen a girl like that. The girl herself ignored them. Only her heightened color and a subtle accentuation of her grace revealed that she was aware of the frank Latin stares. She went upstairs to her room immediately, carrying the small bag she had brought. I recall now that she would let no one else touch it." Once settled in, her real work began. She changed personality and almost overnight, and began to flirt and become so popular with the militaries that they competed for her to accompany them on rides or to galas. It appeared that she would do anything to get them to talk and reveal locations, plans, movements of soldiers to and from various strategic sites. King was dismayed and troubled by this sudden change in her behavior. She tried to warn Helene that, as a stranger in Mexico, she needed to abide by cultural mores of behavior appropriate for single young women of that era. Pontepirani laughed and ignored Rosa's pleas. Helene was at ease with these violent men and the fawning younger officers. Many, at their own peril, fell to her charm. Pontepirani was often accompanied by the commanding general of the area, and through him we now understand her final treachery. As mysteriously as she came into the community, so too did she prepare to depart, and suddenly one morning she was granted a permit to leave for the north. At this juncture, Helene felt that she should at least warn Senora King of pending danger, and thus she urged Rosa to accompany her, to take the same train on which the spy was traveling. Because she respected and actually liked Rosa, she explained perhaps more than she would have ordinarily. Exiting immediately with her would be the only way King could safely reach Mexico City in the near future. King refused to leave her beloved hotel and employees. Obviously frustrated, Pontepirani presented her with a pistol for her protection. However, King declined the offer of a weapon. Nonetheless, Pontepirani left the pistol behind in a final gesture, bittersweet, no doubt, but still hoping to protect a woman she had grown to admire. Shortly after the train departed, the rails were destroyed by a powerful dynamite blast. It was not only the terrible destruction of the rails and train being blown all to hell, but the only rail line to Mexico City was no more, and beautiful Cuernavaca was left to the mercy of Zapata. He laid siege to the city on May of 1914. It fell in August, but then he lost control in this seesaw counter of moves in 1916. Nevertheless, the damage had been done, and the federales were doomed as well. Twisted wreckage of the train and people's broken bodies were scattered everywhere. The ultimate death of over 6,000 people made this a huge win for the rebels in 1914. Pontepirani wrote to Rosa King after her departure from Cuernavaca. In the letter, she explained her position and begged King's forgiveness for her part in the destruction of Cuernavaca. She reminded King that she had left a warning and even a pistol. But King apparently was not in a forgiving mood. She never replied. Rumors floated back to her in Cuernavaca that the body of a beautiful younger woman had been found in a canyon near the train wreck. But then, once she received the note and from Helene, King realized the woman had survived and would continue her dangerous game with history. Along with thousands of Cuernavaca's residents, Rosa King had to abandon the city. Their flight through the mountains was a traumatic experience. Attacked repeatedly by bandits and other starving refugees, they were often killed by bullets, but just as much by starvation, fatigue, cold, and lack of water. And Rosa was haunted by the words of the commanding general when he told her that Helene was really a spy for Villa. His men had caught several traitorous campesinos, peasants, with handwritten messages from Helene to posts outside of the city. Each one was damning, and the carrier was shot on the spot, but no one knows how many of them got through. Apparently enough did, so that the timing was perfect, and damage and carnage overwhelming. The mystique of Villa and his appeal to the people was undeniable. Some feared and even hated the man, but they believed in the revolution. He brought together many individuals who were opposites, like Helene, King, General Angeles, General and President Huerta, President Madero, Zapata, and many others. Villa gathered to his side and on the battlefield some of the most cultured and distinguished people of his time. And despite his crude ways, they all understood for the times he was the general who could get things done, at least in the beginning years. Helene Pontipiani had bragged to Rosa King much later that she worked for both men in their fight for justice against the wealthy haciendados. King wrote that Villa was the picturesque ruffian from the north in whose service Helene Pontipirani had betrayed Cuernavaca and me. I often wondered why, of all the revolutionary leaders, it had been Pancho Villa who won the allegiance of Helene. Stories of her escapades in other lands have drifted to my ears, but I am sure that she was not a spy for merely mercenary reasons. I think there must have been something decadent in her that was fascinated by brutal, primitive strength. Helene, that wild girl who left misery and suffering from the time she exited her parents' home. Eventually, the people won, and Helene disappeared into the mists of time. Did she die of ill health? Was she caught and executed, or did she escape to Europe or the United States and continue her very dangerous game for other revolutionary movements? The beginning of drumbeats of yet another war were being heralded with the opening shots of World War I. Her talents would be very useful there, too. Rosa King was a proper English lady who ultimately preferred adventure to the usual life led by a woman of her position. Born in India in 1867, Rosa was raised on a tea plantation during the years of the British Empire's exciting expansion. Fate brought her to Mexico, where she married and was later widowed in 1905. It was a dramatic and life-changing experience for her. Always facing challenges head-on, she turned to the world of Aztec, conquistador, and revolutionary battalions. Restoration of an almost 400-year-old ruin of a hacienda's manor house in Cuernavaca took up her time during those early years, and she named it the Hotel Bella Vista. People from all walks of life came through the magical doors of the hotel and into her tea room, or if staying the night, they enjoyed dances in company of militaries, leaders, and counter-revolutionaries. Rosa was known and respected by all sides, and her hotel was neutral ground. She wrote, "I should probably have left with the other foreigners when the revolutionary troubles began. As it was, when I invested everything I had in Bella Vista, I cast in my fortunes with the town, and from that time on, everything that happened to Mexico was bound to happen to me also." Helene Pontipirani for a while was part of the exciting give-and-take of those afternoons and evenings, but she also helped to destroy a genteel lifestyle, never to be experienced again. That Rosa was devastated by the betrayal is well documented in her 1935 autobiography, Tempest Over Mexico. It was more a biography of the town she called home, written in her beautiful poetic style, and it is there that she was buried in 1955. No doubt, when Rosa departed her beloved Cuernavaca on the final journey, those who had survived the tragedy of the Mexican Revolution and fled with her over the rugged mountain trails also sensed that the wings of our hearts fell as the thud-thud of La Tierra Mexicana fell upon her coffin. The old-timers who knew her as the Duchess of Cuernavaca also were the ones who understood that surviving the brutal destruction of the rail line between Mexico City and Cuernavaca and living the remainder of her life in an exotic and dangerous land was an astounding tribute to this gutsy and talented English woman.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1. Starting Friday on the Noon Book Hour, we go to our Western shelf to select one of Elmer Kelton's earliest books, Buffalo Wagons. For Gage Jameson, the summer of 1873 has been a poor hunt. A year ago, he felled 62 buffalo in one stand, but now the great Arkansas River herd is gone. In Dodge City, old hide hunters speak in awe of a last great herd to the south. But no hunter who values his scalp dares ride south of the Cimarron and into Comanche territory. None but Gage Jameson. Jameson heads for Texas when the buffalo herds are wiped out in the north, knowing the gamble and dangers that confront him and willing to risk the threat of Comanches. What he does not know is that Ransom King, who has saved his life, will turn against him, that he will have to rescue a white woman captured by the Indians, and that failure and death are near neighbors. Buffalo Wagons by Elmer Kelton, starting Friday at noon and Saturday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Vaccines begin later this week. Some eager Odessa residents arrived at Rattler Stadium early Monday morning, lining up to receive the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. The problem is the first shipment of the vaccine was scheduled to arrive sometime Monday, but actual vaccinations are not expected to begin until later this week. Medical Center Health System officials said MCHS will soon be releasing more information regarding when the vaccinations will begin, MCHS Director of Public Relations Trevor Tankersley said. MCHS officials are asking residents to pre-register for the vaccine at https://secure.echd.org/qdregvax/default.aspx. The pre-registration link is not for setting up an appointment or a specific date and time to receive the vaccine, MCHS officials said. It is a pre-registration tool that will speed up the process of administering the vaccine. Community members that fall under the Phase 1B of the vaccination rollout are the first priority, but the pre-registration link is open to all. For those without internet access, MCH has created a COVID-19 vaccine hotline at 432-640-2220. That's 432-640-2220. The phone line will be answered Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The hospital is expected to receive its first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine on Monday and begin administering shots within days, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said last week. We are excited to be able to roll out these vaccinations to the community, Tippin said. We are asking for patience as we initially roll out this mass vaccine plan. We have been working for months with several entities, including the Odessa Incident Command, on developing an efficient rollout plan, but know we will inevitably face challenges along the way. Our goal is to get these out as quickly and smoothly as possible.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 39 with rain showers, mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
This broadcast is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello again. This is Bill Davis for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with What Unites Us by Dan Rather and Elliot Kirshner. This is the ninth reading from this book, which was published in 2000.